This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is Nick Duke, and we are here to take you on yet another adventure, yet another long book hunt. That's right, we are the long book hunters this week, and we are taking an expedition into the world of Marvel Comics and examining a little book called Old Man Logan. And pretty appropriate timing for this podcast, wouldn't you say, Nick?
Absolutely. You know, as you know, we are celebrating here on the podcast Wolverine Month in honor of the impending release of the feature-length film Logan, which we will be talking about on next week's podcast. And so this month's edition of the Long Book Hunters is a very special look at the most recent Wolverine ongoing series that features, you know, Logan himself rather than X-23 as the, quote, main Wolverine title does currently. But I'd suggest you try not to think about all that and just try to have fun.
That goes for you all as well. Yes. we'll get into some of the intricacies of this here book, Old Man Logan, in just a few minutes. But we do thank you all for joining us this week. I am, as you may be able to tell, again, under the weather. It's not been a good year for me thus far, physically speaking, that is. And I am continually suffering from some ailment or another. But hopefully, like our titular hero of this month, Wolverine, my healing factor will kick in soon and put us back on the road to Rhode Island. Which, as you know, is a pretty long road from here in our studios in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, Nick.
That's a good point, but it is, I think Rhode Island is the old stomping grounds of our place to be overlords, so.
That's true, who we are thankful for and are most happy to do the bidding of.
That's absolutely true.
Yes. And, what could that be, Nick?
Oh, I don't know. Why don't you check and see?
Let me click on our oversized monitor.
It clicks
now? The obscenely expensive hard-traveling Fanboy-a-tron 6000. There we go. The dot, doop, and what's it say? Oh, my gosh. Nick, are you ready for this?
I'm ready for it. Bring it on, because I'm ready for it.
Ho-ho, loon! Still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
Shocking. Shocking news this week here on the podcast.
As always, folks, we endeavor to keep you updated on the employment status of Mr. Loon, ho-ho to his friends. And we will keep you updated on that as the weeks progress. Wow, pretty amazing achievement here. But from that, let's get on to our number one focus of the week, and that is Old Man Logan. Now, Nick, I feel like your grasp of the Old Man Logan chronology is a bit better than mine. Why don't you explain for the good folks out there the concept of Old Man Logan, something that we have reviewed before here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys and even done a long book hunt on. But tell people the difference between what we did then and what we're doing today.
Well, remind me, Greg, that was a column, correct, that we did way back when we were doing the old column? Or was it a podcast? I don't remember.
I can't remember, man. I can't remember.
At some point in the past, we did either a column or a podcast and or a column and a podcast on the Mark Miller and Steve McNiven run on Wolverine, Old Man Logan. This took place, oh, man, I want to say back in the mid to early 2000s. In the pages of Wolverine's solo title, which Miller had a pretty lengthy run on. And the Old Man Logan story was exactly what it sounds like. It was a story that envisioned a future in which all the most of the heroes had been defeated, and Wolverine had quietly faded off into retirement, had settled down, had married, had had children, and was basically running a farm in a post-apocalyptic version of the Marvel Universe. Imagine, if you will, a post-apocalyptic superhero version of Unforgiven, which I think is the most apt comparison that we made at the time whenever we reviewed it.
Yes.
Well, pretty instantly, this book was, you know, regarded as one of the classic Wolverine stories and has been held in high regard since that time. Flash forward, you know, almost over 10 years, and rumors started to circulate that this Old Man Logan story was going to be used as the inspiration for the final Hugh Jackman-led Wolverine solo film. Well, possibly as a result of that, to kind of get some attention back on that version of the character, and also during their Secret Wars event of 2015, during which Marvel revisited various classic stories from throughout their past in a series of alternate dimension miniseries that tied into that event, Marvel decided to resurrect Old Man Logan and basically tell a sequel story that picked up shortly after the events of the original Old Man Logan story. That, what I believe was a 6-issue miniseries, perhaps 5, I can't remember exactly, but that series was written by Brian Michael Bendis with art from the amazing Andrea Sorrentino. This book apparently was very critically well-received critically, did fairly well commercially, and so as a result, and possibly not as a result, they may have had this in the works before Secret Wars, I'm not really sure, Marvel made the decision to reteam the Green Arrow, the critically acclaimed Green Arrow team of Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino for an Old Man Logan ongoing that would spin out of the pages of the Secret Wars miniseries. So when Secret Wars wrapped up, you found a time-displaced version of Old Man Logan who had been returned to the present day of the Marvel Universe, and that was pretty much set the stage for the series of issues we're going to be talking about here today.
Yep, very much so. And this trade paperback, which you can find under the title Old Man Logan Berserker, Old Man Logan Volume 1 Berserker, is pretty interesting in that it only contains four regular comics, and then it also includes the giant-size Old Man Logan by Mark Miller that was the conclusion of the original Old Man Logan storyline.
Correct.
So the actual like main story here that we're following is the – because we've already tackled that story in the past – the main story we're talking about here are the four issues that comprise Wolverine, Old Man Logan, Berserker, sorry. So the premise of this is essentially that Old Man Logan has been displaced, as Nick discussed, from the Wasteland, as it's called, which is the world that he comes from, and returned to the present, what he thinks is the past of his world, but which is actually the present of the 616 Marvel Universe. And as he arrives, he's kind of taken with this concept that, wait a minute, I don't know why I'm here or how I got here, but I've got a second chance now. And he's hell-bent on preventing the future that he thinks is going to happen that happened on his Earth, stopping the fall of the heroes, stopping the rise of the inbred Hulk family, and just generally taking his wrath out on the people who created the bad situation that is the Wasteland.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, you summed it up very well. I mean, obviously, you know, we have a few moments throughout that kind of pull at the emotional heartstrings, and throughout the story we also get flashbacks to his past in the Wastelands, which is in fact the future. So we have flashbacks to the future, as I'm going to call them.
Flashbacks to the future, I like it. Flash forwards for the reader, but flash backwards for Logan.
Yes. It's
certainly a unique device that is used throughout the book, particularly in the numerous occasions when Logan is either sleeping or has been knocked out, which is pretty common in this book, as he picks some pretty big fights with some heavy hitters along the way.
And his healing factor, they mention in the title, is not what it used to be.
Yes, his claws are slower to pop, and his healing factor is on the fritz, basically. It's not, it still works, but it takes him a little bit longer to recover. Although, as he explains later, his healing factor still works great against arrows. So, that's good. So, this story kind of tails Logan, old man Logan, that is, as he...
I think for simplicity's sake, we can call him Logan, seeing as how he is the only Logan in the Marvel Universe.
Right. Although we would frown upon it if somebody attempted to draft him as a separate character from
normal Logan. Yes, we would. There would be quite the uproar if that were to happen.
If that were to happen, yes. So he, you know, he goes around and he immediately starts out by going after a B-list villain, a C-list villain, probably, and then he goes after a little bit of a bit heavier hitter. But instead of encountering what he thinks is Bruce Banner, the Hulk, who's going to eventually create this family of inbred monsters that murder Wolverine's own family. Instead, he finds Amadeus Cho, who is the, help me with this, Nick, the totally tubular Hulk.
Totally awesome Hulk.
Ah, yes. Totally awesome, rad Hulk.
I love that you can't help but hide your disdain for that name every time you're forced to say it on these airwaves.
It's like when Russell says the name of James Olsen on Supergirl reviews. There's just something about it that it is not even necessarily. I mean, yes, I am against the concept of there being a multiple Hulks in general, but in addition to that, there's just something about calling a book the totally awesome Hulk in 2016-17 that doesn't quite sit right with me, and I don't know. I don't know why.
Why?
But in any event, he meets him. He meets the new or Kate Bishop version of Hawkeye. He encounters an old man version of Steve Rogers, which you'll have to explain to me, Nick. I was a little confused on that.
Yes. Okay. So, if you remember, a few years ago when Sam Wilson became Captain America, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The reason he became Captain America was because one of the Marvel villains, I forget which one, was able to successfully remove the Super Soldier Serum from Steve Rogers' bloodstream. And as it turns out, it was the serum that enabled him to survive the ice and have the delayed aging factor, you know, over the last 60 to 70 years. Well, without that, he rapidly aged into an old man, approximating what his actual current age would be if he were running around today. Now, despite the fact that he should be approximately, 98, they still have him running around in the skin-tight suit and doing things. But that's neither here nor there. And he was, eventually returned to his classic form when a living cosmic cube de-aged him and installed him with and implanted him with false memories. But that's another story for another time, I'm afraid.
And why? Because comics.
Because comics, yes.
Now, when Steve got re-aged to the point where he was 115 or whatever, did he suddenly find Aunt May attractive, or was she still too old for him?
I can't comment on that, seeing as how I haven't read or was not reading Captain America or Spider-Man titles at the time, so that's really not for me to say, quite frankly.
Well, then again, maybe it is. It's not for us to say on that either.
No, it really just... I could not answer that question.
In any event, the story is really interesting because it's outlay. The centerpiece of the story is Logan's quest for revenge on these villains who he marks on his arm that he's going after. And he really, you know, not to spoil too much, but he has some mixed results on his rampage and his quest for revenge. But in the midst of him trying to take revenge on these people and encountering the likes of Amadeus Cho and Kate Bishop along the way, we're interspersed with these flashbacks to the future, which I don't know about you, Nick, but to me, these were the strongest points of the book. these were the scenes where you got to see Logan with his son Scotty, with his daughter Jade, with his wife, and also with just the kind of hellish world that he grew up in, and some of the nightmares that are now haunting him to this day. I don't know about you, Nick, but to me, I thought this was the whole thing was good. I enjoyed the stuff in the present day as well, don't get me wrong. But I felt like the, as you put it, flashbacks to the future were the high water mark of this story.
I would agree, and that's something that kind of has been the case with the series pretty much since it started. Especially the first or second one they do, where they're explaining Logan's beef with a villain known as the Black Butcher, and it's a scene of the Black Butcher pretty much emasculating and humiliating Logan in front of his kid, and like even striking his kid in the face, and you just see like how broken Logan was at that point, because he pretty much just stands there and takes it, and resists the urge to go off on the guy. So that was a really cool, really good little moment there, and it makes it feel pretty, you know, pretty cathartic whenever you see Logan brutally murder the Black Butcher's present day self.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's a, as you put it, a very cathartic moment. And certainly I kind of found myself wishing he'd had a little bit more success in his quest to take down the Totally Awesome Hulk too. But that's just me.
Man, you are just, I could just ignore the Totally Awesome Hulk. He just sticks in your craw for some reason.
Well, the same reason Batman Forever sticks in your craw.
That's a good point. Although I wasn't aware of your deep emotional attachment to the Incredible Hulk.
No, it's not an emotional attachment. It's just everybody has their line in comics, you know, that's just a bridge too far. And I think for me, first of all, calling a character the Totally Awesome Hulk
I think it's one of those things where it's written on the cover of the book, but I don't think they actually call him that in the context of the story.
Although when he introduces himself to Logan, doesn't he introduce himself as the awesome new Hulk or something?
I have no, I can't answer that. It's not for me to say, quite frankly.
But the other thing is just the fact that I think the Hulk, what has happened to the Hulk is demonstrative of comics' inability to understand what makes characters unique and interesting, because you lose uniqueness when you make 1,000 characters that are exactly like that initial character. But that's neither here.
You mean you don't like the Red Hulk and the Red She-Hulk?
I am not a huge fan. I'm not a huge fan of Agents of Smash, in which we have A-Bomb. And his catchphrase, A-Bomb's away.
Scar.
Scar, yeah. The son of the Hulk, except on Agents of Smash, where he's just
some other person.
Some other person,
kinda, yeah. Kind of like how the She-Hulk, Jennifer Walters, is a brilliant attorney in the comics, but on the Agents of Smash, she's a stunt car driver because it offers her an opportunity to be on camera, which is all she really cares about in life.
Yes, exactly. That exactly. And how the Hulk has a weight bench that he works out on to build his muscles.
we're spiraling out of control once again.
That's right. But let's get to the meat of the matter. This, of course, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, this is a book that is the product of the acclaimed by us Green Arrow team of Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. Lemire, of course, is the writer, and Sorrentino is the artist. Now, typically, we usually start with the writing when we're discussing things like this, but I think we need to get right into it and talk about the incredible, beautiful, not ugly, beautiful artwork of Andrea Sorrentino, who we praised him when he was on Green Arrow as the best working artist in comics at that time.
Yep.
And man, he hasn't missed a beat moving on to Old Man Logan. Absolutely. What a visual showcase this entire story is, from the action pieces that have his trademark red boxes and things like that you might have seen in Green Arrow, to the intimate scenes, to the scenes that just really take advantage of the entire area of the comic book page. It's just brilliant.
I agree completely. You know, one thing I would be really interested to see, Greg, is typically I'm not, you know, big on reading the original scripts for these stories, but I would love to see a Lemire and Sorrentino script at some point to see what exactly their method is, what their working process is, because I wonder if it's Sorrentino who is coming up with these innovative layouts, or if it's Lemire who is directing him, or if it, perhaps it's a little bit of both. I've long wondered that about this collaboration, but no matter who's responsible for the idea, the execution of it is carried out in expert fashion by Andrea Sorrentino. One thing that he uses here numerous times throughout the four issues is we all know that comics have a heavy reliance upon the use of onomatopoeia, you know, boom, or in this case, snicked being a perfect example. And numerous times throughout these four issues, he will draw, they will letter the onomatopoeia in giant letters and actually have images inside the letters. And it's just a, it's a really cool and innovative technique to use to kind of put a new spin on a classic comics trope. And I think that's the main reason I love Andrea Sorrentino so much is because, you know, a lot of the other comics artists that we love, whether it be Jim Lee or, Ivan Reis, Ethan Van Sciver, you look at their art and you go, man, that's just great classic superhero art. With Andrea Sorrentino, you look at it and it there is nobody else in comics who looks like Andrea Sorrentino does on the page.
No, it's completely unique. It's completely different. And in a way that isn't distracting from the story, but in a way that enhances the story.
Right.
And it's the way that he directs your eyes, directs your vision across the page is remarkable. And for me, I can't think of a better drawn. I mean, certainly Wolverine's had some great, perfectly drawn stories over the years, but this is certainly right up there with the likes of Frank Miller and John Byrne and some of the other guys that have drawn great Wolverine stories over the years.
Absolutely agree. And that's the other thing that I wanted to mention is, you know, Lemire and Sorrentino obviously worked together on Green Arrow previously, but it wasn't – I don't think theirs is a partnership where you could just apply them to any character. I think you have to have – I think you need the right marriage of character and creative team. And this whole concept and this character of Old Man Logan could not have been – more tailor-made for Lemire and Sorrentino. So they really fit with the overall tone of the book. The art is gritty, I mean, but not without being, you know, over the top. It certainly has its moments of being bloody and violent, but you never get the impression that the book is all about, you know, gore and decapitations, for lack of a better term. So, yeah, I mean, throughout the book, Sorrentino just continues to steal the show in pretty much every issue. I mean, there is not a single issue of this series, and not just these first four issues, but I can say of the series to date that Sorrentino has drawn where there has not been at least like one just mind-numbingly good splash page. The dude seems to excel and has become the master of the modern-day splash page in that his level of detail in some of his images is among, you know, the most impressive things that I think I've ever seen. So, you know, it's highly unusual, as Greg said, for he and I to sit here and lead with the artist or to praise the artist right off the bat. But I mean, Lemire certainly carries his weight, no doubt about that. But Sorrentino here is the star of the show.
Absolutely, yeah. Well said. You're on all of that. Sorrentino is definitely the standout, I suppose you would say.
The but bull let's talk of the woods, if you will.
Yes, not unlike the bull of the woods. You know, the cock of the walk, daddy. You know, various other, you know, only two men in this world that was ever bad. One of them was John Wayne, and he was dead. The other one was Andrea Sorrentino, Daddy.
Absolutely.
Now, let's move on to the other half of that equation, though. Jeff Lemire, the writer,
yep.
Crafts, I think, a really, really good story here. We've talked before about Jeff Lemire, how he is he's a guy that thrives, seemingly, on these, I don't want to say tertiary characters, but these solo characters that are kind of maybe a little bit out there, maybe a little more – adult-themed characters, perhaps. Mm-hmm. His work on Green Arrow was astoundingly great. His work on Wolverine is astoundingly great. He just gets the voice of Wolverine. I think it helps that he is Canadian, so I think that helps with capturing the voice. But I don't know, man. He just steps into this character and writes Logan better than I've seen Logan written in many, many years.
Yes, particularly when it comes to the interior monologue, which is something now that is used in almost every modern-day comic book on the stands. But I would argue here, Lemire is among the best writers of an interior monologue that I have seen in quite some time. I mean, that technique, honestly, has been a little played out, I think, over time. But Jeff Lemire has just kind of reinvigorates it here to the point where, like, I almost looked forward more to what Wolverine was thinking as opposed to what he was saying. So it was
right.
It was a cool, especially the interior monologues when he is narrating his memories of the wasteland. I mean, that's everything.
Yes, and it's especially impressive that they could create memories that interesting of Wade Barrett's finishing move. That's pretty.
I'm not familiar with this Wade Barrett of which you speak. However, I am familiar with Fake News Bennett, which is a thing apparently.
I heard about that today, and it sounds awesome. In any event, yes. Look, you're completely right, though. I mean, the interior monologues of from Lemire of Logan are really they stand out, and they capture the Wolverine that I like to see, the Wolverine that has his own unique voice, that has his own unique perspective, that doesn't talk like a generic superhero, which for some reason in the last 10-15 years, some guys write Wolverine just like a normal, you know, like Captain America would be talking in his inner monologue, and that's not Logan. And this is Logan. This is a version of Logan that, to me, re-sparked my love of the character and reminded me of why he's my favorite Marvel character. And certainly I hope that the movie can take some cues from that and can capitalize on this characterization, this bitter, world-weary old man that is just trying to help, in his own sadistic way, is trying to help out not just his family, but the families of so many others that have been affected by what the villains did on his world.
Right, absolutely. One thing I also thought was cool was Lemire getting to write Kate Bishop, you know, because he's been writing the Hawkeye series, and so he kind of got to play with her a little bit, and so seeing him get to move her over here into Old Man Logan and kind of have a natural, you know, a very organic feel to that little team-up issue, I liked that as well, so I thought he wrote her very well. I liked his Old Man Steve as well, as weird as it is to say Old Man Steve.
Yes, absolutely. Old Man Cap and Old Man Logan had a pretty interesting interaction with one another, and you gotta love Logan's reaction upon seeing him the first time, and he's like, "You ain't Captain America. Rogers never went old," I think is what he said.
Yes.
Just a humorous situation. And you see the depth of his paranoia, the fact that he thinks that this is just a Mysterio illusion, basically, that is making him see
which is a callback to the original story in which the conceit was that Mysterio was able to trick Logan into murdering all of the X-Men, essentially, which is what led him to put the claws away for good and head off into retirement.
Yep. So that was certainly a great dynamic. And Kate Bishop's a character that I just kind of fell in love with anyway through reading the Matt Fraction Hawkeye series.
Yeah.
So always fun to see her pop up and to see really all of these great characters from the Marvel Universe pop up throughout the story that we see. I will say I thought, you know, the ending of this one was a little abrupt, I felt. In that Logan has kind of resigned himself to just kind of wandering the globe, and he finally sees Iceman and Storm. They finally find him, and in his inner monologue, he realizes that he found a reason to live, basically. And unlike the Hoobastank song, the reason is not you, dear reader. The reason is, I guess, the other X-Men. But it kind of ended on a weird note to me. I know that it continues on into the regular series, but
yes.
Did you find that to be the case for you as well?
Yeah. Going back here and rereading it, yeah, the ending was rather abrupt because if I'm remembering correctly, they kind of have the scene there in his tomb, in the present-day Wolverine's tomb, where Logan finally realizes that, you know, this is not the present that he remembers of his past. And oh no, I've gone cross-eyed. anyway, and you kind of go straight from that into him just randomly walking around, and then, oh no, here are the X-Men. Although I will say, as abrupt as it was, I did think they sold the emotion of that reunion, of Wolverine seeing the X-Men again alive for him, what is the first time in decades.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely, no question. That was very well done, very well executed, excellently executed, one might say, if one wanted to. And, I thought that was really well done. And the colors throughout this, which I believe the colorist, Maiolo is his name, I think?
Yes.
It was the same guy that was their colorist on Green Arrow, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that was the case, but
It really creates a unifying field to everything, because now I almost feel like you could pair this with their Green Arrow run and read them side by side, you know?
Yeah, thematically, for sure. I mean, not in terms of direct connection, but there are certainly some themes and some visual stylings that that have some similarities. And then, of course, like you were saying, I mean, this also pays homage to some of the classic Wolverine stories as well. You know, obviously the original Old Man Logan, and then not so much an homage to that story, but an homage to one of the great Wolverine creators as they actually do their version of the classic Dark Knight Returns image of Batman jumping against the lightning, as Sorrentino does an image of Wolverine in silhouette jumping against a backdrop of lightning. So it's a pretty cool image.
Oh yeah, that was really awesome. That was a great little throw in. It really does feel like as weird as it would say, because when you think about rebooting a character, you always think about the character being young again.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, doing the opposite feels like it has rebooted the character of Wolverine. By taking an old man dystopian version of the character, it almost feels like they've rebooted Logan and gotten him back down to the root of why people identified with him in the first place, which is his warring natures, the beast inside him versus the good man inside him, the family man versus the loner, and that's kind of what they get at in the heart of this story.
Yeah, and they certainly would go on to expound upon that in future issues. The next story arc, in fact, features his flashbacks to the future, feature him recounting the story of how he met and fell in love with his wife, while the present-day story has him attempting to protect a child version of his future wife, all the while trying to deal with the awkwardness of not wanting to tell her, like, what their relationship could potentially be in the future. So it's a very interesting emotional dynamic that they continue to play off.
Yeah, no kidding.
So,
no, that's great. So, I mean, overall, this is a pretty short story. So there's not a whole lot more to delve into here, I don't think.
Right.
Overall, obviously, we're both recommending this one, right?
Yeah, I would recommend it. Granted, I'm not an X-Men aficionado, and I haven't read a ton of X-Men in my, comic reading career, but I would say it's one of the better X-Men series that I've come in contact with in a long, long time. If you're even the slightest fan of Wolverine, at the very least, this is worth hopping on Marvel Unlimited for one of those 30-day free trials if you don't already have an account, and check these issues out. 1 through 4 are already up on there, and I think they've actually got like 1 through 9 or 10 up there right now. So lots of Old Man Logan there on the service. And, we have to mention, unfortunately, in the coming months, they'll be adding more and adding the complete Lemire-Sorrentino run. Lemire and Sorrentino together, I think their last issue comes out in April, and I think Lemire is carrying on for like 2 or 3 issues with a fill-in artist, and then Both of them are leaving the title permanently after May. So starting in June, I believe, there'll be a new Old Man Logan creative team. So pretty easy to find this entire thing, I would think. I'm sure the second trade is probably already out, and volumes 3 and 4 can't be far behind.
Yeah, and I certainly recommend going out of your way to try and get a hold of this. It was really impressive to me. Nick's been singing the praises of this series for the better part of a year now. So I can't help but agree with his assessment. It's a great series. Check it out and let us know your thoughts. And with all that being said, that's going to pretty much wrap up our long book hunt. certainly we invite you all to let us know your thoughts on Old Man Logan. You can contact us on Twitter. I'm at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. We have email addresses, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. And, of course, join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and engage with us in all manner of discussion related to the world of comics. When we come back on the other side of the break, we will have for you the rundown. We will have for you reading and watching. We will have a veritable cornucopia of exciting comic book happenings right here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Clocks are running late. Paint by the morning sky.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We hope you enjoyed the Long Book Hunters there in the first half. And now it's time for a little segment, a segment in which we recount the biggest news and notes from the week that was in the world of comics. It's a segment we like to call
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
And there you have it. This is the Rundown, folks. And let's start things off in the X-Men film universe. And we're going to start off with the long-discussed movie based on Rob Liefeld's famous creation, X-Force. It now officially, allegedly, has a director, as Joe Carnahan has been hired to replace Jeff Wadlow as the director of X-Force. Carnahan will reportedly write the film's script alongside Ryan Reynolds, who has also signed on to co-star and executive produce, which means Deadpool will be in X-Force. Carnahan was previously attached to Daredevil at one point. He was going to reboot Daredevil and actually created a really cool, like, 70s-inspired sizzle reel.
Yeah.
He wanted to do an NC-17 take on Daredevil, which would have been very interesting, very Frank Miller-inspired.
And do it period piece, if I'm not mistaken.
He wanted to do the
full 70s Monty with it. And it was a really cool piece of footage. I mean, you know, mostly just spliced together from pre-existing works. So it was a really cool idea. But I think he's most notably known for directing The A-Team, a film that I never saw. So,
I can't... It was good. It was entertaining.
I'm sure it was. It had Rampage Jackson. And after all, how are you going to get the moon off you? You know, it would seem to me, based on what little we know about the Deadpool sequel that's supposed to be coming out, I believe, in 2019, that that sequel is supposed to feature both Cable and Domino among the cast. So it seems like that film should lead pretty naturally into this X-Force film, where you'll have Cable, Domino, and Deadpool running around with a couple of other, you know, characters that'll probably be introduced in this one. So it seems like they're certainly laying the groundwork for what this X-Force movie is eventually going to be.
Right, yeah, no, that very interesting, and I'm digging it. I'm down with it. You know, I think X-Force is a book that I read a lot as a kid, and I think there's potential there to make an interesting movie that stands out from the other X-Men movies. So, bring it on, I say. Well, from that, let us move over to the television world of Marvel, I'm sorry, of DC, and that is the DC CW television universe, as everyone knows, currently consisting of Arrow, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, The Flash, and soon to consist of Black Lightning. Well, this week we learned that CW's Black Lightning has officially been cast. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This is a show that was originally, of course, going to be on Fox. It is now headed to the CW. And Cress Williams, C-R-E-S-S Williams, has been cast as Black Lightning in the series, a.k.a. Jefferson Pierce, a retired superhero who is pulled back into action when his daughter is recruited by a local gang. So this is interesting in that they're going with an older take on Black Lightning. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this casting here, Nick?
I have nothing to make of it, because I've never heard of this guy, nor seen him in anything. So, apparently he played a role in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, which would explain why I haven't seen him in anything, because I tried to avoid that show like the plague.
But, oh, you're a piece of garbage. Absolute garbage.
You know, you and the good folks over at the Geek and Sassy podcast can bond over your mutual love of And we have, and we will. And your mutual owning of a vagina, but that's neither here nor there.
And we have, and we... Wait a minute. You tried to sneak one by me, you cheeky monkey.
Cheeky monkey. So yeah, I really don't know what to make
of it.
Sticks
and stones, my friend.
I really don't know what to make of it, but like you, I think it's interesting that they're going with an older take on Black Lightning. I will say, I think, somewhat controversially, I actually think that this show should be set on Earth 38, which is the Earth of Supergirl.
Mainly, I agree completely.
Give her some crossover potential that she doesn't currently have. I think it would fit really well.
Agreed.
Now, that's all being said, if they're still intending on keeping those Earths separate. You and I have theorized in the past that perhaps for one of the crossovers, they could eventually do a version of Crisis that would
bring them all together.
So they still could,
but for now, why not put Supergirl and Black Lightning on the same Earth?
I agree. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Totally agreed. So that's a good thing. We'll see how Black Lightning turns out, but from the unknown to the equally unknown, but one that I have strong opinions about, let's go to the printed page and go to Marvel Comics and a somewhat unique situation, folks, that was tweeted out by Marvel Editor-in-Chief Axel Alonso earlier this week. It is an image of a Weapon X-like jar that is holding a specimen in it, and the specimen inside appears to be the Hulk with Wolverine claws. Hulk-verine, folks. Hulk-verine. I have no idea what this means, but it certainly appears that they just thought, hey, you know what makes what would be awesome? What if we put the Hulk and Wolverine together and made one super creature out of them? It looks dumb. I'm not a fan of the image and what it may represent. Maybe it'll be something cool. I don't know. I shouldn't pass judgment on it. But I'm just saying the image is laughable in nature. It looks like something I would have come up with when I was 10. Now, there's anything wrong with that, by the way. You know, 10-year-olds come up with a lot of great ideas, but this just seems like a bad idea. Like just combining two things for no reason other than, gosh, that would look cool.
As someone who read Civil War II, my official prediction is that this is going to be revealed to be nothing more than a ploy that is being used by the Hydra brainwashed version of Captain America during the upcoming event Secret Empire. I am assuming this is some sort of weapon that he is developing for the purposes of use during that event. During the events of Civil War II, you know, Bruce Banner, the Hulk, was shot and killed by Hawkeye, and there was a big, long debate about that amongst all the heroic community. Well, it was eventually revealed in a tie-in. Stop me if you've heard that before, related to a Civil War event, but it was eventually revealed in a tie-in that the entire chain of events that led to Bruce Banner's death was set in motion by Steve Rogers. And in that tie-in series, he was seen absconding with the body of Bruce Banner and taking him to an undisclosed location. So my assumption is that this is going to be some sort of Hydra hybrid weapon that will be turned on that will be unleashed upon the heroes of the Marvel Universe during Secret Empire.
Undoubtedly, I'm going to waive my right to discuss that because I haven't read Secret War, and I'm just going to assume that you're probably right.
I hope I'm right. If this is actually like some sort of intended ongoing character of some sort, that's not a good idea.
It could be the not entirely awesome Hulk.
Not entirely awesome Hulk. This might be the Secret Empire version of Ragnarok or Klor, if you remember from the original Civil War, that the cloned Thor that they brought back for no adequately explained reason and had him blow a giant hole in the middle of Goliath's midsection.
Ah, yes. Goliath. He was dead. He was deed.
And then they had to have a funeral for him in his giant form because they couldn't shrink him back down.
Well, such is nature when you're a giant growing superhero.
But yeah, so I mean, I don't really know what to make of this other than, you know, my theory that it's all just going to be a temporary Secret Empire related piece of business. A gimmick.
Indeed.
A gimmick, if you will.
A gimmick. That's right. But let's move on from that and let's go on to our weekly segment, the DCEU Corner.
Yeah, but unlike most weeks, I think we have generally all positive news to report. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. In fact, although the negative news here is that we kind of sound like idiots after last week's show, because we talked last week about how Matt Reeves had left the Batman and dropped out of the project. Well, just a week later, it's official. He has signed on to be the director of The Batman.
Yeah, it happened pretty quickly, too, because, I mean, in between the time that we recorded the show and the show was released online, this came together. So by the time the show actually came out, there, you know, we were talking about Matt Reeves walking away from The Batman when, in fact, he had already walked away and returned to The Batman. So,
yep.
Yeah, we didn't sound great in that exchange, but we kind of had the Matt Reeves discussion a couple weeks ago when they announced that he was initially announced, or not announced, but it was initially rumored that he was going to be the guy. So I think it's fair to say we're both, what's the term? Lukewarm on the idea. Like we're,
lukewarm.
I'm
yes.
fine with it, but I can't say that it excites me in any real way because I don't know anything about those Apes movies.
Same here. I haven't seen either of his Apes movies. And I don't know much about the guy. I mean, I you know, like I said last week, I got a little excited about the concept of a Ridley Scott movie, but I don't think that was ever really a possibility. So hey, you know, a lot of people seem to be excited about the Matt Reeves hire. So let's see what he's got.
At the very least, you know, the initial report was that DC was targeting him, or Warner Brothers was targeting Matt Reeves once Affleck left, and so at least it shows an ability for them to get the guy they really wanted. Now, whether or not that guy, you know, winds up, you know, doing a good job or not remains to be seen. But I would count this as a minor public relations victory for Warner Brothers, which is something they haven't really had in quite some time.
Agreed. And speaking of public relations victories for Warner Brothers, and speaking of Batman, I got a just some wonderful erection-producing news this week. Yeah, which is probably a TMI way to describe it, but hey, I called
it. Did it last longer than 4 hours?
Yes, I had to go to the emergency room. It was a terrible ordeal. Mm. But that's beside the point. Nightwing, my favorite comic book character, Dick Grayson, Richard Grayson, whatever you want to call him, is joining the DC Cinematic Universe because, according to the Hollywood Reporter, Lego Batman movie director Chris McKay is in talks. There's that classic phrase again, in talks, to direct a live-action Nightwing film. I am over the moon about this. I think this is a long overdue project that could be awesome. You know, I was hoping this was going to happen after Dark Knight Rises, if you recall,
yes,
with Joseph Gordon-Levitt in the role. And so this is awesome. I am so stoked and surprised. I think this announcement kind of came out of nowhere, especially given all the issues that have been going on with some of the previously announced DC movies. So, hey, I mean, not that this means anything because, you know, hell, they announced The Flash years ago with a director. So we'll see what becomes of it. But, hey, man, They are intent on making a Nightwing movie, and if that's the case, I am down, especially since I think this is a great opportunity for them to prepare for the possibility of Ben Affleck departing as Batman, because since they have an older Bruce Wayne, this would be a great way to establish Dick Grayson as his replacement.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe, after the critical and commercial success of the Lego Batman movie over the last few weeks, if they perhaps didn't go to Chris McKay and said, hey, you know, we'd like to work with you again. We're impressed with what you did. You know, what would you like to work on? And maybe this was his idea. I don't know. That strikes me as something they could have done because, like I said, the Lego Batman movie has been very successful for them. I will be interested to see the development of this one. I want to see how what the tone of this one is going to be, how it's going to be handled given the current landscape of the DCEU, which has been, you know, rather grim and fairly self-serious to this point. Now, granted, we've been told that that's going to be changing as we go forward with Wonder Woman and Justice League and things of that nature. So I'm interested to see what kind of Nightwing movie they set out to make, because I think we would both agree that while you can do a grim and gritty Nightwing movie, that might not be the best course of action to take for the character's big screen debut, if you will.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. You know, I think there needs to be a mix, as there isn't any great Nightwing story.
Gotta find the balance, yeah.
There certainly has to be humor, because he's a humorous character. But I think that there does need to be that groundedness that you get from the Batman universe.
Sure,
you
know,
there
it's
needs
just
to be a little bit of that tragedy. But I certainly agree there needs to be... You can't make this like Batman versus Superman. You just can't. You have to make this a movie that has a little bit of the tongue-in-the-cheek thing going on, where, you know, because the lead character pokes fun at his own rogues gallery. So, you know, I think they need to embrace that a little bit.
I think that'll be one of the more interesting things is, do they go with an actual Nightwing villain like Blockbuster or somebody like that, or do they go with a Batman villain, lift from the Gotham rogues gallery, so to speak?
That is very interesting. You know, I saw it bandied about that, you know, it might be an opportunity for them to do Red Hood as a villain, but I don't really see that happening.
That would be cool.
But, yeah.
I would think Red Hood would have to be a Batman film, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but there is something to be said for the idea of Jason coming back and...
Well, you could easily do, you know, the Batman, with whatever story they want to tell there, do this Nightwing movie, and then have them both together in a eventual Red Hood movie that kind of, and it could kind of feature all the members of the Bat family. If the rumors about Gotham City Sirens potentially featuring the Birds of Prey turn out to be true, you know, you could have, you know, Batgirl and Nightwing and Batman all dealing with the return of Jason to Gotham. So I think there's some potential there. But granted, that is many films down the road, and I, you know, not to be a negative Nancy, so to speak, but again, we got to wait and see what Justice League does before we get too excited about any of these future films, I think.
Although now, in hindsight, I almost think now that, like, I wish that they had known they were going to do a Nightwing movie ahead of, like, farther in advance, because I think Deathstroke would make much more sense as Nightwing's primary villain than as Batman.
With Matt Reeves coming on, though, I would assume that as the director, he will have the opportunity to make changes to the script if he really feels the need to, so... Is there any guarantee that Deathstroke is still the primary villain of the Batman? I don't think we can take anything for granted when it comes to the plot or story of the Batman at this point.
I mean, it's possible that Archie Andrews could be the primary villain, for all we know.
Why you got to bring Archie into this, Greg?
Well, I mean, you're an anti-Archite. I figured you'd enjoy the concept.
I'm not an anti-Archite.
Batman beating on Archie Andrews.
Batman doesn't need to beat on Archie Andrews. It's fine. Let Archie do Archie's thing. And by doing his thing, I mean having sex with his music teacher and starring in bizarre-looking television shows that I have no interest in ever watching.
Well, quite if you're not interested, quite frankly, turn the channel. I mean, it's that simple. If you don't like the product...
I don't have to turn the channel because it's never been on
my
television.
Instead of bitching online and going on Twitter and bitching at JR's BBQ, just turn the damn channel. It's very simple.
JR, I got a question for you. What's your favorite George Jones song?
Why, Baby, Why would probably be right near the top of my list.
Yes. And that's right. We are men in our late 20s to mid 30s who traffic in George Jones references. So there you go.
Then again, I'm also a big fan of White Lightning.
White Lightning.
Pappy started cooking that White Lightning, quite frankly. In any event, let's move on to our final story of the rundown and stay in the DCEU because yes. Gotham City Sirens is a thing that's happening.
Apparently, yes.
And will be directed by David Ayer.
Yes. We will see if that winds up being a positive thing or not.
Right. And he has tweeted out an image this week on his Twitter account, which is where people tweet things.
Indeed.
And he tweeted out a simple image of the comic book villain, Batman villain, the Black Mask, who is one of the more ruthless gangster characters in the Gotham universe. So now people are speculating that Black Mask will be the primary villain of the Gotham City Sirens movie. Your thoughts, Nick?
I like it. As we discussed in Under the Red Hood, I think there's a lot of potential in certain incarnations of Black Mask being used. I think there is certainly potential in Black Mask and Joker interactions, because we know that the Joker will likely play some sort of role in this film. And given the relationship that those two kind of had in the comics during the Under the Red Hood storyline, a relationship that turned fairly antagonistic, it kind of makes sense because it provides two different forces for the Sirens to be caught between. So I think from all instances it makes sense, and I will reiterate my call from a couple weeks ago to have Al Pacino play the Black Mask, even though I know it's never going to happen.
Ooh-ah! Yes, that would be cool. Black Mask is a cool character that's never been done on film, which I think is key. I'm interested in seeing
that's what we really want to see is things that haven't been done before. Like, you know, Deathstroke, if it happens, I'm certainly all for. Black Mask, Hush. There's so many. Batman has the deepest rogues gallery in all of comics, and there's no reason you can't move past the Joker, Penguin, Catwoman, Two-Face realm into some deeper pulls.
Yeah, and Clayface. We saw a version of Killer Croc. Scarface.
The ventriloquist has always been my bizarrely most wanted Batman villain on the big screen.
I mean, there's just a litany of them. I still say that there's room for a good Riddler on screen, we've never gotten.
I would agree. Although Gorsham was pretty good in the incarnation he was portraying.
True. But I mean, on the big, I guess that was a big screen movie. Yes.
Batman the movie from 1966.
But still, in the modern
context,
the modern era. Yes. So we shall see where all that leads. But that's the end of the rundown, folks. That can only mean that it's time for
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Oh, man, just a classic tune. I'm a great, great singer. And we're here to bring you another edition of Reading and Watching. We're going to get you kicking off here with reading.
Nope. Because it was a nope.
No?
No, we're not. I can't. Greg, I have waited. I have waited this entire show, and I'm not going to wait any longer. Let's kick it off with watching.
All right. Let's kick it off with watching. And I'm assuming you don't want to go in the usual chronological order here.
Nope. We're skipping past. We're going to skip past the CW shows and then circle back around because we got to take a little trip over onto AMC to what is, without hyperbole, I am not even joking when I say, instantly for me, a top five, possibly a top three episode of The Walking Dead ever.
Wow.
Instant.
Wow. High praise. And I think I know why. Because this week's episode of AMC's The Walking Dead focused almost entirely on the character of Eugene Porter.
Dr. Eugene Porter.
Mr. Eugene Porter. And as well as the character of Dwight. If I know one thing about Nick, it's that he's a huge fan of the character of Dwight.
You make it sound like I hate the character, and I don't. I just don't find anything about him compelling.
And yet this is a top three episode for you. Why don't you explain to the people why?
Why? This episode, as Greg said, is almost entirely Eugene-centric. And in addition to being a wonderful reminder of why Eugene is the most unique and at times endearing and charismatic character, I mean, charismatic in a utterly bizarre way, I'll grant you, but he's just so unlike any other character on the show, and that makes me, you know, love him so deeply. But you combine Eugene's typical awkward nature with the idea of Eugene being on a power trip, and you get legitimately probably the funniest Walking Dead dialogue in the show's history, for my money. And I mean, not just once or twice, but almost every scene in this episode, even when they were doing serious scenes, had laughs in them. And I just felt myself, like, just enjoying the show on a level. Not that I haven't enjoyed episodes before, but I'm saying enjoying it in a different way than I've ever enjoyed an episode of The Walking Dead before, just because it had just this entirely different feel and pace to it.
Yeah, Eugene was phenomenal in this episode. Absolutely hilarious. A welcome respite from the serious nature of most of the episodes. Everything from the very beginning, when he goes into the room and they play the Easy Street song that tortured Daryl, and instead you see Eugene bopping his head along and digging it. That was hilarious. The immortal line when he takes the stuffed animal from the woman at the line, and he's like, "I do not even know what this is called. I'll call it a gerbil gutch," or whatever it is he calls it. when he tells the lady to bring him the orangey stuff for his pasta. Playing the video game and explaining the plot of it to the girls that have been sent to him by Negan. Amazing. Absolutely amazing performance. Just stellar writing. Just everything was really good.
Yeah, I agree. So the plot of the episode, for those, you know, who don't watch the show and are interested, was essentially Negan attempting to woo Eugene into serving the Saviors, using that brain power of his to help them solve various issues around the Saviors compound. And he tempts him with the friendship of Negan's various wives. He tempts him with the ability to pretty much take anything he wants from the lesser inhabitants of the compound, which leads to one of the greatest lines in the history of the show, when Eugene cuts in line to take some medication from this old lady, and the old lady yells at him to get back in line. He starts to get back in line, and then he turns around, and he says, "My name is Dr. Eugene Porter, and I have been named to the recently created position of chief engineer of this facility, which means I report directly to Negan, which means you report directly to my ass." And I literally, like, just started, like, belly laughing on the couch when that happened. It was one of my favorite moments in Walking Dead history.
And as any listener of our show knows, we love my ass.
My ass, indeed. So, I mean, pretty much the entire episode, and even, like, you know, obviously the comedic elements were mostly why I enjoyed the episode, but as I pointed out to Greg earlier, I also thought this episode was essential from a storytelling standpoint, because I have seen some criticism online that this episode felt very redundant, that we've spent episodes inside the Savior's compound before, that why do we need to do another one? To me, this episode represents the flip side of the coin that is the Daryl episode from earlier this season, in that episode, we saw the experience that Daryl had when he rejected the Savior's advances, and here we get to see what life could have been like for Daryl had he chosen, you know, made a different choice. So I thought, even from a plotting standpoint, it was pretty much brilliant the way they handled it. Eugene falling back into his old tried and true lies that he knows will work on people, and them continuing to work on people, bringing back the bit about the Human Genome Project from earlier in the show, two or three seasons ago, that he used with, such success on Rick and Abraham. Him basically bullshitting his way into a position of power with the Saviors. It was pretty gratifying to see as a fan of one Dr. Eugene Porter. And we don't want to get too heavily into spoilers about what happened at the end of the episode, but I will say this, Greg. If I were Dr. Porter, and I were trying to make a choice about which group to pledge my allegiances to. Perhaps, Greg, I would choose to go with the group that shows me the proper respect of addressing me by my doctoral title.
His unearned doctoral title.
Listen. He holds a doctorate in biology and some other science that I can't remember the word right now. And that's all.
I will remind you, he also once claimed to have met T. Brooks Ellis.
Of the Human Genome Project.
But
who said
no,
that his
I,
hair
all...
made him look like, and I quote, a fun guy.
Yeah,
also,
no, he was out. Oh.
Also, if we're going to ship characters on this show, if we're going to do the stupid Rishon thing that people apparently did, even though I didn't know that was an online movement until it happened on the show, let's start the official shipping of Eugene and whatever the blonde bitchy savior's name is. It's time for Eugene to get a little action, I think.
I'm good with that. I think that makes sense. I think she was starting to fall for his charms. What do you think?
I think so. I think it's clear that Negan's wives were starting to, you know, let's just say the mullet, you know, was doing what it was brought here to do. That's all I got to say about that.
It has certain aphrodisiac qualities. Just ask every woman in Tennessee in 1993 that went to Billy Ray Cyrus concerts.
But also, how awesome were the brief interactions between Negan and Eugene, particularly Negan posing to him the problem of the decomposing walkers. And when Eugene blurts out a response, Negan not only loves it from a practical standpoint, he says, not only will that work, but it's just badass.
Also, they started to sow the seeds for Dwight's eventual turn, it seems. There was a really cool little Negan moment where he took out the doctor of the facility with the foolish belief that Eugene is going to now fill in as the physician for the saviors.
Well, quite frankly, you know, Eugene, I'm sure he'll be up to the task. There is nothing Dr. Porter cannot accomplish.
Or at least nothing he can't figure out, I guess.
That's right.
So, yes, Walking Dead was phenomenal this week. Phenomenal.
Amazing.
I understand you, Nick, also went and saw Lego Batman.
Yeah, I did.
Tell us how it was.
I went and saw the Lego Batman movie. You know, I enjoyed it. It didn't... I'm weird when it comes to kids' movies in that I think I'm too much of a cynic to really ever say that I truly love a kids' movie. Probably the last kids' movie that I just was completely blown away by was Toy Story 3, and I'm sure a large portion of that had to do with my pre-existing attachment to those characters from my own childhood. But I enjoyed the movie, you know. It definitely has – I think it works on a whole other level if you are a hardcore DC Comics fan and especially a hardcore Batman fan. So many callbacks and references – to pretty much every era of Batman on film. So, you know, don't want to say too much about it, but it just had some great jokes and great humor. And the ending, my lord, it felt like a filmed version of what it was like when you were a kid and you had your Batman action figure and you just started pulling random other action figures out of the toy box for Batman to fight. Like, I don't want Batman to fight the Joker. I want Batman to fight, you know, the Predator or the Alien or whatever. And just, like, the closing sequence with various cinematic villains from five or six other major franchises going up against Batman and him, nonsensically being able to defeat them all was a pretty cool little touch.
Yeah, sounds interesting. I'm very excited to watch it once I get the opportunity. It'll probably be when it comes out on video.
Yeah, I wouldn't, like, it's not one that I would think that unless you have kids, I would say certainly take them to see it. It's certainly worth your money there if you're going to be taking your kids to the movies anyway. But for people such as yourself, Greg, single guys, you know, I wouldn't, it's, you can wait until it's on DVD for sure.
Very good, very good. Excited about that one. And with that being said, let's get to our CW shows. And Monday kicked things off with an episode of Supergirl that focused on Mr. Mixel Spitlick, however you want to say it.
Mixel Spitlick. I don't know.
In any event, Mixie, we'll call him. and basically focused on him coming to Earth and trying to woo Supergirl, trying to get her to marry him. And I got to be honest, Nick, I loved this episode. I thought it was tremendous. We had Kara and Mon-El continue their mating dance, as you if you will, as Mon-El becomes furiously jealous over Mixie trying to steal Supergirl's affections, even though he never really had a chance of getting them. But in Mon-El's eyes, the fact that Mixie can literally warp reality to his every whim gave him a leg up. We see some more Alex and Maggie stuff. We saw no James Olsen, importantly.
I was about to say, it had that one thing in common with pretty much all the best Supergirl episodes, and that it kept the James Olsen to a minimum, and in this case, virtually non-existent.
Virtually non-existent. And it even had a cool subplot for Wynn, who typically is given nothing to do except to be James's sidekick. So
yes, it gave Wynn the subplot of encountering being one of the first to encounter a life form from another planet. And fuck it.
Is that a reference to something?
Yeah, it's a line from Clerks 2, I think? Clerks 2 or Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, one or the other.
Mm. Very good. Yes. No, he really
Clerks
nice,
2, yeah, it's definitely a line from Clerks 2. Your favorite film.
My favorite film of all time. So good.
Now, Greg, that film did teach us valuable life lessons. Let us not forget.
That's true. That is correct. In any event,
Supergirl with
Supergirl,
Mixon,
yes. Yeah. No, the Wynn subplot was very good and very welcome, I thought.
Yes.
I love Wynn when he's done properly and when he's not just, you know, there to prop up James. And,
love of Kara, which was cool to see him kind of finally have a legitimate romantic interest outside of Kara. And I kind of liked the character of Lyra. I think that character, from what I've read of various synopses and stuff, is supposed to be sticking around. So I'm excited to see what they do with that character going forward.
Yeah, I am too. And I hope it works out for Wynn. He deserves it. He's been a long-suffering character on the show.
Agreed.
And the heart of the episode was Mixie and Kara and Mon-El. And Mon-El and Kara just have off-the-wall chemistry.
Right.
Just great dynamic, great characterizations there. But last week we were somewhat critical of last time we talked about it, we were somewhat critical of not casting Gilbert Gottfried as Mr. Mixlipidlick.
I don't know that we actually said that, but at first I was very upset. I was a little there was a variety of factors. One, I've never been a fan of the character of Mixlipidlick to start with. Two, I didn't like the idea of not having him be an imp, like having him be CWized, for lack of a better term, essentially be a extremely attractive person in their mid to late 20s.
Right.
And three, I didn't like the fact that it wasn't going to be Gilbert by God Gottfried.
Yep. But much to my surprise, the guy that they got ended up being pretty damn entertaining.
Yeah.
He did a great job, and I ended up really loving this episode because of it.
Yeah, I mean, he had kind of an innate chemistry and really – or not innate chemistry, innate charisma, I should say, that really brought a certain level of charm to every episode, every scene he was in. I really enjoyed it. So I was very surprised by how much I enjoyed this take on Mixlipidlick, to the point that I'm fine with him being kind of a recurring villain going forward, though I wonder how much they can really do, how many different ways they can trick him into saying his name backwards.
Yeah, that's which if you ever get to see the Superman animated series, Nick, I highly recommend the first appearance of Mixie on Superman the Animated Series, because they do a recurring bit where literally there's like a 5-minute montage of at the beginning of Superman convincing him to say or spell his name backwards, and he does it like just like 10 times in a row super quickly, and it's hilarious. And yeah, I'd highly recommend that. In any event, Tuesday night brought us The Flash, of course, and the first of the two-part Gorilla City event. And this, of course, involves Gorilla Grodd, one of the classic Flash villains who we met in Season 1, and sort of his plot for revenge, ultimately, on the people who cast him onto Earth 2. And Barry and his friends cross over to Earth 2 to try to save Harry Wells,
yes, who, they
who has
bring
been
back.
Captured, who has been captured by Grodd, and hijinks ensue that involve Solovar, the classic hyper intelligent ape of Gorilla City, and all of the other gorillas in Gorilla City. Nick, what did you think of this one?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one as well. I think at this point we have all come to realize that the CW DC shows have some issues with CGI, and that was certainly the case here. To the point that I felt like they were actively trying to hide Grodd at times by having him telepathically control other people so that he didn't have to actually appear on screen. He spoke through Harry in a couple of different scenes throughout the episode. So they were clearly trying to limit the CGI where they could. There was no way around it, really, when they got to the big... There was a big gladiatorial arena scene where Barry fought Solovar, and the CGI was pretty rough there. And unfortunately, they chose to use the misguided tactic that we knocked Supergirl for a couple of weeks ago by using lots of slow motion in areas where it really didn't make sense, because with the CGI being so poor, all the slow motion did was call more attention to how bad the CGI was. All that being said, I really, really enjoyed this episode. I love when these shows are able to do things that would only feel in place on their respective shows. And doing this Gorilla City arc is something that would really only work on The Flash. You couldn't do this on Arrow. You probably couldn't do this on Legends. I mean, you could do it on Legends, but it wouldn't be, you know, a true Legends type of story. But this really feels like a Flash story brought from the page straight onto the screen. And it was a little cheesy for sure, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with that when it comes to The Flash. You need that from time to time. So I love the hell out of this one, man.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. I don't know that I enjoyed it quite as much as you did, but I did love it in its own way. And definitely agree with you on the CGI issues, but I also agree with you on how much fun it was. Like you said, this was a quintessential Flash episode. Seeing the gorillas kind of take over. We also got to see the return of evil Harrison Wells, even if by proxy, because he was being controlled by Grodd. But I thought that was awesome. We essentially got three Harrison Wellses in this episode.
Yes.
And what was that old mathematical equation I told you about earlier this year, Nick? The more Wellses, the better.
That's true. And we even got a scene of Harry and HR sharing a scene together.
Together, that's right.
This also featured the return of Jesse Quick to the show, and it seemingly she's going to have a bigger role going forward as she makes a decision to stick around on Earth 1. So, you know, I enjoyed that as well. So, I mean, pretty much all the little subplots kind of worked for me.
Yep. There. Everything's really lining up. So, yeah, big fan of that episode as well. The question I have is it going to get confusing when, you know, if Solovar comes over to help against Savitar?
Oh, Solovar. What if Solovar is Savitar? Wouldn't that be a twist?
Ooh. What if Poindexter is Thanatos?
Well, we know that to be an absolute fact, Greg, that Poindexter is indeed Thanatos, and Thanatos is Poindexter.
That's true. These are just some of the facts you can find out every week here on the longest-running weekly
episodic
comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Yes.
Very good. Let's move on to the next show on Tuesday night, which, of course, was Legends of Tomorrow, DC's Legends of Tomorrow, to be specific. And this was an episode that took us back to the very foundation of our country, well, of your country, the country that we live in, but not that we record in, of course, that being the United States of America, the Revolutionary War. And
Greg?
Yep.
No, it didn't.
It didn't?
The episode took us forward to the year 3000 to see how, you know, pieces of the Spear of Destiny were being hidden by Dr. Midnight, and then took us back to the past, to Camelot, for a episode entitled Camelot 3000.
Oh, I'm conflating that. You're right, because I'm remembering 2 weeks ago's episode.
Which we've already talked about on these airwaves.
A classic flub from the Gregster. Yes, so we did. We went back to Camelot. That's right. I'm on track now. Took us all the way back to Camelot and another country that we don't record in. And in England, of course. And this, you know, we saw Dr. Midnight. We saw we were brought up to speed, basically, on what happened to the JSA. That they divided up the pieces of the Spear of Destiny and took them to different points in time at the behest of Rip Hunter. Well, things didn't turn out too good for Dr. Midnight. But in the past, Stargirl is playing the role of Merlin in the mythological court of King Arthur. And, of course, in keeping with Legends' theme of the season, Nate and Ray Palmer are on kind of different sides here, as Ray is very excited about going to King Arthur's court. Nate is not, because he does not believe it actually exists. So that leads to some pretty funny banter. Damien Dark shows up at one point. Evil Rip Hunter is in the episode. And I've said this off the air, but as much as I enjoyed Rip Hunter in season one, I think he is so much more entertaining as a villain. I think he has just been killing it, because he gets to show off a little more of his charisma in the villain role, whereas he was kind of morose and somber in the babyface role. So I enjoyed this episode. Well, I'll touch on my one kind of hang up about it that kind of drags it down for me in just a minute, Nick. What were your thoughts on this episode?
I enjoyed it overall. I don't think it was up to the quality of the, you know, the episodes of Legends that we have seen since the return from the mid-season break, but I still enjoyed it overall. And it also continued the time-honored tradition in Legends of Tomorrow of having Sarah encounter various women from throughout history and seemingly turn them a little bi in their sexual leanings, as she shares an intimate kiss with Guinevere of you know, the Arthurian legend. So enjoyed that aspect of it for sure.
Yes. Now, speaking of Arthurian legend and speaking of kind of some of the female characters on the show, one thing that I did not like, and the one thing that kind of dragged the episode, because I loved a lot of this episode. I thought the action was really good fight scenes. I enjoyed Damien Dark in particular, was tremendously smug as always. But one thing that did kind of drag this episode down for me is I really didn't like the characterization of Stargirl. First of all, she looked much older than I would anticipate Stargirl to be, which, as you've pointed out to me, may have been the idea. But the main problem I had was using Stargirl as someone that went back in time and fell in love with King Arthur and now is adamantly going to stay because she's so in love with King Arthur. That just doesn't seem like Courtney to me. It really doesn't. And the way that she acted in the episode, I wasn't really impressed with the acting.
Everyone can fall in love, Greg. I mean, come on.
No, certainly. But, I mean, it just, the whole thing just seemed, I don't know. There are characters to do that with, and I really feel like it's kind of a waste of Courtney. And plus, again, she's Stargirl. She's supposed to generally be a younger type character, and they really played her as an older character in this. And
right. Well,
I didn't dig it. I have to be
earlier
honest.
Earlier in the season, when we were first introduced to her in the JSA episode, she appeared younger, and we were told that there was, you know, a pretty good amount of time that elapsed between the classic World War II era adventures of the JSA and their disappearance, which I believe they've dated at like 1956 or something like that. So it makes sense that she would have aged at a certain point. Plus, we don't know how many, from her perspective, how many years she's been present in Camelot.
That's true. I guess ultimately the big thing for me is I feel like Stargirl is a character that I've waited a long time. I mean, she was on Smallville briefly, but I've waited a long time to see her, you know, get into this world. And I don't really love that her first storyline is that she falls in love with King Arthur. So, you know, that's just me. But that was the only thing that I had negative about the episode. I thought it was really good otherwise. Very much enjoyed it. And particularly enjoying Sarah's stint as captain of the ship. She's doing a great job, very entertaining, and interested to see what happens now that Rip is back on board with Gideon.
Yeah, can't wait for next week's episode, because Legends is, of course, taking one of the random CW breaks this week and not airing an episode.
Which are completely sensible and always explainable. And let's move on to Wednesday night and Arrow. Now, Nick, why don't you remind the folks what Arrow was about this past week?
That's code for Greg has forgotten what the plot of Arrow was this week. So the main thrust of Arrow this week featured a triumvirate of past female villains breaking out of prison. And those female villains were, of course, China White, Cupid, and random black police officer who I don't remember the name of from some season and don't honestly remember the episode in which she was introduced. But anyway, they break out and have the, you know, the plan to locate a stockpile of cash that Tobias Church left behind whenever he was taken down by the Green Arrow, and they're going to set out to find it, you know, in hopes of making themselves rich. But the interesting subplot here is that Susan Williams, Oliver's, you know, love interest / possible journalist versus politician rival, basically accuses him of being the Green Arrow, given the information she has accumulated over the course of the season to this point, and especially given the little tease we had of what they were going to do with her in the Russia set episode from a couple weeks ago. So that subplot all kind of comes to a head, and it comes to a head with her making that accusation and then Thea and Felicity making a very unique decision to take matters into their own hands, so to speak.
Yes. Another great episode of Arrow. Big fan of this one as well. The three villains are whatever, but I think that combining them together helped, because on their own they haven't been very interesting. So putting them together, they were at least a physical foe that led to a really cool fight scene, actually, where Team Arrow tried to take them down. Oliver and China White had a nice little throwdown with each other, which is always nice. So that was cool. But like you said, the thrust of the episode was Susan Williams and that whole subplot. And I have to be honest, it's a tough call, but I ultimately agreed with Thea's decision, Thea and Felicity's decision. Unlike some people on this show, I never liked Susan Williams. I never trusted her. She was scheming behind Oliver's back the entire time, investigating him behind his back the entire time. And
you mean
it was obvious.
She was doing her job? What a terrible thing for a journalist.
She was doing her job, but why was she dating the guy? She was lying to the guy's face. She was dating him only to get information.
Greg, let me ask you a question. Let's put you back in your reporter shoes and say you were cast to cover Stephen Amell for something, and he decided he wanted to throw you a little action on the side. Would you turn it down?
That's neither here nor there. That is a hypothetical. I would never be in Stephen Amell's league. Come on now.
Well, I'm just saying.
And I will remind you, she came on to him, not the other way around. She came on to him because she was trying to get information.
Listen,
she was going to ultimately reveal his identity as the Green Arrow. She got what was coming to her.
And then she decided not to, because she ultimately actually cared about him, and she brought the information to him first. She easily could have revealed it publicly, but chose to talk about it with him in private. And as a result, Thea makes the decision that basically ruined her entire life.
She could have gone to him. I think she was trying to get him to confess it to her so that then she could then come go public with that. I have no reason to believe she would have kept the information, because otherwise, why would she keep going after it?
It's a story, Greg. It's a story. She had a professional obligation to chase it down. Now, listen, I don't have any great attachment to the Susan Williams character. I think she got dealt a pretty shitty hand here by Thea.
She was dealt a shitty hand, but she dealt others a shitty hand. I'll remind you what she dealt to Thea earlier in the season, and what she dealt to Oliver, and what she was going to do to Oliver. So I don't feel nothing for Susan Williams.
She was on the path to redemption, Greg, and now we have.
No, she wasn't.
Thea has kicked her down the path to becoming a supervillain of some sort.
Oh, well, I'm sure she will be a supervillain. She'll show up, and then maybe she'll get an arrow through the face like she deserves.
My God, the Susan Williams hate. Is this just misplaced aggression at not having Olicity be a thing this season?
Well, maybe. But listen, I have been open to this new Black Canary, have I not?
Yeah, well, for some reason, it looks like they're going to have Diggle sex her up.
Now, what do you base that on? The fact that they had a nice, friendly conversation?
The fact that they've had tender moments together in, like, two consecutive episodes.
Diggle's not going to cheat on Lila.
I'm not saying that he is, but when's the last time we saw Lila? You know, for all we know, Barry is screwed with the time stream again, and Lila doesn't exist.
Lila may not exist.
But no, I just the Thea thing. She all of a sudden was randomly acting very aggressive in a way that she hasn't really this entire season. And then that last scene with Oliver saying, "Right now, I'm just worried about my kid sister." Like, did I miss something along the course of the season? Was there actual like cause for concern? Was Thea acting out in some way to make him have any reason other than this one incident to be legitimately worried about her?
Well, I think the fact that this was such a major incident was the reason, you know, that he didn't think that she was capable of something like that, you know, doing something that was so the end justifies the means, you know?
I suppose. It just felt like that scene came off to me as if he was concerned about a pattern of behavior, and I didn't really see a pattern of behavior. But
no, I don't see that either. But nevertheless, we come to that point in time when we have to rank the episodes from the week, and this is a tough one for me, Nick. What are your rankings for the week?
I'm gonna go Flash, Supergirl, Arrow, Legends.
I am going to go Supergirl, Arrow, Flash, Legends.
Fair enough.
And this is the first time, I think, all season long that I've voted Supergirl number one. So congrats to them for a nice, nice bounce back these last few weeks.
Yes, I'm sure they're hanging the plaque on their wall as we speak.
As they should. The Greg Phillips voted me number one on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. The longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all on Place to Be Nation.
Yep.
Award. With that being said, let's move on to. Oh, by the way, before we get there, I did see, it's not comic book related, but I did see John Wick 2 over the weekend. It was awesome. Go see it. Anyway, let's move on to reading.
Yep.
And stop me if you've heard this before. I only read two books this week. 2 weeks. Nick,
you are aware that we do a comic book podcast, correct? Like,
I am.
The idea.
You are aware that I've been on my deathbed since roughly the end of December, right?
You haven't been on your deathbed.
I have. I have felt in a bad way for many, many months now. Several months.
Well,
2 months
at
least.
I would suggest you do a nice relaxing activity that can be done from a prone position on your couch. Something that requires no physical effort whatsoever. Reading comics.
It's hard to read right now. It's hard to read.
It's hard to read.
Yep, it's hard right now. Hard to read.
I don't need to know what's hard right now. That's none of my business, quite frankly.
Well, you're the one that got me talking about Stephen Amell.
Well, you were the one saying that journalists shouldn't sex up Stephen Amell, and I just felt like you needed to put yourself in Susan Williams' heels for once.
Oh, my.
Why don't you lead off with your number two book of the week, Greg?
I will. I'll do just that. And it's Superman number 12 by Peter Tomasi, Patrick Gleason, and Doug Monkey. And it is the first part of a crossover with, or not a crossover, but a, well, maybe a crossover would be the word, but with Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, and it is called Super Monster, Part 1. It was okay. A step down, I thought, from what Superman's been one of the best Rebirth titles, and I thought this was just a pretty good comic. Not bad by any means, but it just wasn't terribly interesting to me. I'm not a big Frankenstein fan, and I thought it was a little predictable, and that I kind of saw where it was going the whole time. So, I don't have a ton to say about this one, except that I am interested to read the next issue and see how it gets concluded. And I really enjoyed the stuff with Lois and Clark. I mean, they write Lois really well, but overall, just kind of an okay comic.
Yeah, yeah, I remember having a very similar reaction when I read it a while back. My number three book of the week to get me kicked off here is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 15. This continues the Quest for Hope storyline, and I read this very early on last week, so some of the finer details have kind of slipped out of my mind, so I can't speak with any real, you know, level of depth about it. But I will say this just continues to be an outstanding Green Lantern comic. The dynamic between John and Sorenik with the greens and the yellows interacting, and Kyle and Hal running around with St. Walker, it has that classic Geoff Johns feel that we've praised the book for, you know, over the last couple months. And it really is a big return to form for the character of St. Walker in particular, who, I'll be honest, since Blackest Night, it's kind of felt like they didn't really know what to do with that character. And this kind of feels more like the version of St. Walker that we all know and love. So big, big shout out for Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 15.
Awesome. Big fan of St. Walker myself, so that's good to hear. Why don't you go ahead and do your number two as well?
Sure. My number two book of the week is Batman Detective Comics 951. This is part one of the League of Shadows storyline, kicking this off in a big, bad way. Loved this book, of course. Lady Shiva being reintroduced to the Rebirth version of the DC Universe in a very intriguing fashion. Really heart-wrenching scenes between Kate Kane and her father, Jacob, as he is still imprisoned there at the nest, so to speak, and it really sets up kind of this emotional, what do I do dilemma for Kate, because it's clear at this point that some of the things her father was talking about in their previous storyline were true, and that he was right about a lot of things, and now she finds herself torn between her dad, who is convinced that a great evil is coming to take down Gotham, and Batman, who insists that the League of Shadows is just a myth. So between that and some really cool stuff with Cassandra Cain, you just have the makings of, you know, what is the best Batman book on the shelves right now. Although All-Star Batman is rapidly nipping on its heels, I will say.
Man, you know, after the Court of Owls, shouldn't Bruce have just learned to start accepting that these secret organizations are real?
Yeah, I would think so, but sadly he has not.
Very, very good. Well, let me move on to my number one book of the time period, and that would be Action Comics number 971. And this is, again, part of the Men of Steel crossover. Or not Men of Steel crossover, the Men of Steel event. And this one I really enjoyed. I was entertained by it throughout. Clark, a powerless Superman and a powered Lex Luthor, is an interesting dynamic as they work together to take on the Lakal and Zaid, who are trying to take them out, basically, for crimes that Lex has not committed yet, but they say will commit in the future. I also enjoyed the little line here that Lex throws at Clark, where he says, "You one thing's for certain, you're different than your predecessor, quicker to act." And so I enjoy how they continue to point out differences between this Superman and the New 52 Superman. Also loved the ending of this. It had one of the coolest ending, or one of the most intriguing endings of a book that I've read in the last few weeks, in that, John and Lois are hanging out together in Lois's apartment in Metropolis, because in the last issue, John abused the fact that Lois and Clark were gone to have a party with his friend Kathy, where they ate ice cream and tore up the house. So Lois makes him go with her to Metropolis. And at the end, there's a knock on the door, and when John opens the door, it's this fake Clark Kent that's there, and he now knows that Lois has a son. So, intriguing ending here to a good comic.
Good to hear. Good to hear that you're enjoying that one a little bit more than I did. Moving on to my number one book of the week, I've got Wonder Woman number 17, another installment in the Truth storyline by Greg Rucka and artist Liam Sharp. Great moments here with Hippolyta, who can almost innately sense that something is going wrong in her daughter's life, and you kind of see her despairing to be able to reach out and save Diana in some way, even if she's cut off from her at the moment. Continued scenes of Diana struggling with mental illness and struggling with her own, her own past and the way it's having an impact on her psyche right now. But the biggest thing about this issue is the stuff they do with Barbara Ann Minerva, formerly known as the Cheetah. And don't want to spoil anything, Greg, but she makes a choice here at the end of this episode, or this issue. And I say she makes the choice, but she's kind of forced into it. And she makes a choice in order to benefit Diana and Steve that is one of the most heart-wrenching and heartbreaking choices I've seen in comics in a long, long time. And is setting her up to be one of the most sympathetic antagonists in all of comics. I really, really love what they do with that character here. The Cheetah, a character that I always thought was cheesy and stupid, is rapidly becoming one of my favorite villains. It really feels like almost like the Wonder Woman version of what Geoff Johns did with Sinestro in terms of the reclamation project for a particular villain. So, loved the hell out of Wonder Woman number 17.
That's awesome. Can't wait to catch up on that one for sure. What else you got for us in your quick hits?
Well, I have a bottom book of the week, but I really want to say this is one of the strongest weeks in recent memory. So I pick a bottom book out of a technicality only because I really don't have anything bad to say about Action Comics 974, the latest installment in the mild-mannered storyline. Only reason that this finds its way onto the bottom of my list is because it wasn't quite as consistent as the other books I read this week, in that I loved everything having to do with Lois and the false Superman, but I didn't really find the Clark trying to save Superwoman story to be all that interesting. But all the fake Clark stuff was fantastic. And then just a few quick hits, real quick. Spider-Gwen number 17 continues the sitting in a tree storyline. These two characters of Miles and the alternate version of Gwen Stacy just have so much chemistry. I'm loving this crossover. It makes me wish they could be featuring each other's titles more regularly. Justice League of America, number 1. Enjoyed this one. I actually probably think the Rebirth was a little bit better, but still shows them juggling, all these characters, and they all get a moment, and they all have distinct voices. So Steve Orlando seems tailor-made to write this this team book. And then finally, Teen Titans, number 5, bringing a conclusion to this initial Teen Titans story arc. Again, like I said about JLA, just great moments for all the individual characters, and even Damian learning to see the value in teamwork a little bit. So, just another great Teen Titans read.
Awesome. And so that brings an end to reading and watching. And with that, we come to the end of the podcast, and it's a little bit abbreviated this week, but hey, we needed a short one after some of our marathon sessions lately. As mentioned earlier in the show, we invite you to let us know what you thought of the episode. Contact us on Twitter, Facebook, or email and let us know. Nick, what do we have coming up in the next few weeks for our good listeners out there?
Yeah, so we have, as I said, it's Wolverine month, and we are rapidly approaching the release of the film Logan. Perhaps by the time you're listening to this podcast, you may have already seen the film, or at the very least, the film may be out in your local market. So next week, we are going to be featuring a full-length review. The first half of the show will be taking up primarily with discussion of the film Logan, so you'll have our full-length review next week in addition to our usual reading and watching and rundown segments. 2 weeks from now, we'll be going off the page for a very special look at the first Wolverine solo outing, X-Men Origins Wolverine, which I know Greg is in particular looking forward to revisiting. And then finally, we'll be wrapping up Wolverine month with a countdown of our top 5 X-Men the Animated Series episodes from that early 90s run. So lots of good things coming up for you here on Wolverine month. And then we will be closing out the month of March, because we have 5 Thursdays in March. We will be closing out with a giant-sized edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys that will also happen to be our landmark 50th episode in our run. We will be doing a look back at, we're approaching the one-year anniversary of DC Rebirth. We haven't quite gotten there yet. But with that in mind, we're going to be doing our podcast we're calling DC Rebirth 1 year later, as we look back on some of the highlights of DC Rebirth and what is working for us. And on that show, we will be joined by an illustrious series of guests from across the Place to Be Nation pop feed, those guests being Russell Sellers of Sellers Points, Todd Weber of Conversation Comics, and Jennifer Smith of Geek and Sassy. So big things coming up here in the month of March.
And that's not to mention any special guests that may pop up along the way.
May or may not pop up along the way. That's true.
Yeah, we very well could have some appearances from unexpected visitors. So be on the listen for that. And until then, we do thank you for listening. We invite your feedback. I do apologize for my uncharismatic performance this week. I'm continuing to battle whatever it is I'm battling. And hopefully I'll be back on my game next week. And we will talk to you then as Wolverine month rolls on here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Be sure to check out Logan and get ready for our review next week. There's a woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. That white skin got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire tinted skies. I'm well dressed, waiting on the last train. Standing on the gallows with my head in the news. Any minute now I'm expecting all hell. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. This place ain't doing me any good. I'm in the wrong town. I should be in Hollywood. Just for a second now, I thought I saw something move. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts. Gonna dress in drag. Only a fool here would think you've got anything. A lot of water under the bridge, a lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy, times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Been walking 40 miles, a bad road. If the Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to
as far away from myself as I can. Some things are too hard to touch. The human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with the losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first woman I meet. Putting her in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy, times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Just don't show it. You can hurt someone and not even know it. The next 60 seconds could be like an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. I'm in love with a woman that don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in a lake. I'm not that eager to make a mistake. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in.